explains that we're continuing our study of the prophecy of Isaiah this morning, and particularly it's chapter 56, 9 to chapter 57, verse 21, which is the conclusion of chapter 57. The subject at hand is peace. Peace is actually a pretty big idea, according to the prophet Isaiah. There's a theme running throughout the whole long portion of God's Word. Back in chapter 9, early in the prophecy of Isaiah, as Isaiah is forecasting the arrival of Christ into the world some 700 years after the birth and life and death of Isaiah, he speaks of Christ as the Wonderful Counselor, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. In chapter 26, Isaiah talks about living a sort of life in which your mind is so steadfastly set on God, your mind is so stayed on God, that you live in a state of perfect peace. I wonder if you know anyone you describe that way. In Isaiah 52, he talks about how good it is to be involved in carrying the gospel. He says how lovely on the mountains are the feet of those who come bringing good news of peace, announcing peace. And here in chapter 57, particularly verse 19, God offers peace to everyone. Peace to him who is far and to him who is near. God offers us peace. That's something Isaiah has been saying. He says it again this morning. And the testimonies, both historical and in our church family, that we heard in the choruses that we sang prepared us to consider this idea of living in a state of peace. Now, when God offers his people peace, you can think about it, you should think about it along three lines. You can think of peace that we desire the most, you can think about the peace that we tend to disregard the most, and there's the peace we require the most. This is on the outline, it's not that confusing. First of all, the peace that we desire the most is peace with circumstances. Circumstances are hard to ignore, because that's what circumstances are, the stuff that you see in the circumference of your life, what you notice when you get circumspect. It's what's all around you. And the things that are around us unsettle us and threaten our peace more regularly and more obviously than many others objects of peace or lack of peace. There's the whole range of things in our circumstances that threaten our peace and knock us out of whack. There's the peace or the lack of peace in regard to petty annoyances, for example. No one would say these are major issues. They're minor by definition, but they can really get to bug us. They can throw us off. You go on a Saturday morning into your garden shed and you pull out the lawnmower because it's time to start cutting the grass every week, and you pull that lawnmower cord and nothing happens. So you pull it again and nothing happens, and you pull it again, and about 20 or 30 pulls into it as you're reliving all those boyhood memories of trying to get your outboard motor started and it wouldn't start. You begin to realize that it's probably time to change the crazy spark plug. So you didn't want to go to Canadian Tire this morning. You wanted to sort of spend the time in the garden, even if it was cutting the grass. But you get in the car and you drive to the store and you park and you get in the lineup. You buy a crazy little spark plug and you stand behind someone who's buying something that doesn't have a price tag. And you wait for hours. You get it. You get home. You change the spark plug. You pull the cord. Nothing happens again, and nothing happens again. So you phone up the lawnmower repair person, and he says, well, it is May. We can look at it, but not for 3 or 4 weeks. In July, we'll be out in the front yard calling you in, but now you can't get anyone to fix a lawnmower. And no one would say this is important, but it's annoying, and it can turn you into a cranky person, and peace would be better. Besides petty annoyances, there's peace or lack of peace in regard to real irritation. Sometimes the irritation comes from almost equally incidental issues, but it's important because it threatens to undo something that's important to you. I mean, nobody really cares about my private relationship to my lawnmower. I may hate the thing, but nobody minds. But if petty annoyances or minor irritations threaten the relationships which are a part of my life, then they become really significant. Now, let me not speak autobiographically here, but let me speak about some of you and say there are some of you who are perfectly normal people, but you have to be married to a messy person. And so day by day, there's this irritation of living with someone who doesn't know that light switches are for turning lights off and cupboards are for closing and toilet seats are putting down, and it can irritate you, and it would be a petty annoyance, except that it may in fact jeopardize your relationship. And you can think about your 50th wedding anniversary if the Lord gives you and your spouse that many years together, and you stand up and you celebrate the marriage, but all the while your children are thinking, boy, what a, you know, glad that's over with. What a bunch of grumps they were. And if petty annoyances turn you into a person at war, or constantly in conflict with your spouse, then it's no small thing. It's a big thing. And then there are big things which call for peace and may make peace a real challenge. There's health problems. Perhaps you've got some very creepy feeling in your body, and you know you ought to go to a doctor and get it checked out, but you're not going to because you're afraid it could be something really serious. And you figure that one out. Is that brainy? So you don't go to the doctor because you might have something seriously wrong with you. Or you do go to the doctor and he confirms that you do have something seriously wrong, and then it scares you to death. You're not at peace, but you need to be at peace. Or perhaps your finances have been a problem for a long time, but they're threatening to get disastrously worse. You're on the verge of economic collapse, and you're scared to death. And whether in petty annoyances or in minor irritations or with real problems, there's such a thing at being at peace. And it comes from a right relationship to God. Paul talks about it, the Thessalonians of all people. They were the Christians who were being ruthlessly persecuted. And some of their loved ones were being dragged out of worship services, away to be tortured, away to be imprisoned, away to be executed. And Paul says to them as he concludes his second letter to the Thessalonians, may the God of peace grant you peace in every circumstance. And you say, if they could be at peace while living in persecution, so I can be at peace though my lawnmower needs to be fixed, or though I cannot get along with the person I'm married to, or though I may have a serious problem that even threatens my life. There's such a thing as peace with circumstances, and it's a stunning thing when you see it. If there's someone who's going through hard times and that person is at peace, you know what I mean. It's a stunning thing to see someone who has got the knack of being at peace in all circumstances. That's the peace we desire the most, because the lack of peace is hard to ignore when it's coming from the circumstances of life. There's another sort of peace that we're inclined to ignore. Sometimes we disregard it for a long period of time, and it's peace with people. Sometimes we disregard the lack of peace with people because it's out of our control to fix it. Paul recognizes that in Romans chapter 12 when he says, as far as it is possible with you, be at peace with all people. As far as it's possible with you. Sometimes it's impossible. Sometimes you can't get into a state of peace. And some people just get used to that, and they live in a state of conflict with a person for a long, long period of time. And although it doesn't press upon us because we tend to avoid the people we're in conflict with, and so we can ignore each other and ignore the problem, it ought not to be ignored. Because peace with people is more important than peace with circumstances. Because people are more important than circumstances. Because people last longer than circumstances. And if the person that you are in an ongoing conflict with happens to be a fellow believer in the Lord Jesus Christ and has also received eternal life, then think about this. You're going to spend eternity together. And the one thing you know about eternity for sure, much is mysterious, but the one thing you know about eternity is it lasts a long, long time. And you could end up in the mansion right next door to this person that you haven't been talking to for years. And that may be a grief to you because you can't do anything though you've tried hard. Or it may be that you haven't tried very hard because you've just disregarded the person and disregarded the lack of peace. But God calls us to be at peace as much as it's possible with us, with all people. Peace with circumstances is the peace we desire the most. Peace with people is the peace we disregard the most generally. But there's another sort of peace which we require the most, and that's peace with God Himself. It is, according to the Apostle Paul, the first benefit, maybe the most notable benefit, of being right with God. Romans 5:1 says, therefore, having been justified by God through faith, we have peace with God. The very first benefit listed, the very first benefit of being declared right or justification, is to be at peace with God. Many people treat peace with God as an optional extra. As much as they ignore the people that they're in conflict with, they ignore God even more consistently and act as if peace with God is not a necessary thing. People who achieve a state of atheism, working hard and for the time being successfully at ignoring the existence of God, set aside the whole issue of peace with God as nonsense. And people who work hard to be agnostics and hold to the position that you can't know that there's a God, so why bother trying, also manage to ignore the whole issue, to explain away the issue of peace with God. But there are people who know that there is a God, who have given up trying to be atheists, who admit that agnosticism is a cheat, who acknowledge that there is a God, but still they ignore the issue of peace with God. They live out of peace with God, and they act as if it's not that big a deal. But it is. It's totally a big deal. In fact, it is the deal, because all other aspects of peace are held up or conditional upon peace with God. See, you have no reason to be at peace with your circumstances except that you are in a state of peace with God and you sense His pleasure, you know His approval, you know He is on your side, or more properly, you're on His side. So you know that He's working all things out for good. So you can look at the loss of a loved one. You can look at a serious health problem. You can look at the irritation of living with a person who thinks you're messy, or that you think is a neat freak, or what. You can look at ongoing irritations peacefully, knowing that God is orchestrating the details of your life for a purpose, that there's great purpose in all the details of life. That's so plainly the message of the Bible. But that peace with circumstances is a state of delusion unless it's grounded firmly upon your relationship with God being in a state of peace. And peace with people is a miracle and requires peace with God, because actually people are hard to live with. All people are hard to live with. You go to 50th wedding anniversary and the grand old gentleman stands up and says, "I just have to say, my wife has been nothing but pleasure to live with, a sweetheart who's never caused me any consternation for 50 years running." You know he's exaggerating, right? You know he's carried away by the celebration. The helium's got to him or something, because it's not true. No one is pleasant to live with 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 50 years. No one. We're all irritating to each other. So we need grace to help in time of need, even if the need is just getting along with the person you're crazy about, so that you don't drive each other crazy, which is what happens when people who are crazy about each other start trying to be married to each other. We need help, help in time of need, and the help is called the undeserved favor of God. It's the grace of God. So where there's people who have attained a genuine sense of peace with each other, there is God at work. Peace with God provides us with the stuff of which peace with each other is made of. It's called the fruit of the Spirit. Joy and peace and patience and gentleness and kindness, these are the things by which we come to a state of genuine peace with one another. Peace with circumstances is possible because God offers it to us. Peace with people is possible. Maybe not total peace, because it's not entirely up to you, but to a great measure, peace with people is possible as God fuels us with the fruit of the Spirit. And peace with God Himself is possible because Christ died on the cross to forgive us our sins, to purchase our salvation so that God could declare us right in His sight, and the benefit is peace with God. And where we see it, it's a stunning thing. If you know someone who you would use the word peace to characterize them, you know, when I think of so-and-so, what I think of is peace. There's a person totally at peace. And if you compound that with perhaps a greater than average share of difficulties, it's an absolutely stunning thing. It's a stunning evidence of the fact that there is a God who holds people together and offers them the ability to live in a supernatural way. That's what God does, and it's a stunning thing when you see it. And what Isaiah wants us to see in our text this morning is that it's totally out of the realm of possibility for a certain sort of person. What he says as he concludes chapter 57, what he said when he concluded chapter 48, you may or may not remember, is that there is no peace for the wicked. That's how chapter 57 ends. God says there's no peace for the wicked. So we ask, what's the problem with the wicked that there's no peace for them? Well, we get the details. If we start back at chapter 56, verse 9, "All you beasts of the field, all you beasts in the forest, come to eat." Here's Isaiah the prophet anticipating the judgment of God. As you know from your study, he's looking ahead to the time when the Babylonians, as the chastening arm of God, are going to come up against Jerusalem, and they're going to tear the city apart, and they're going to destroy many people and carry many others away to slavery. It's the punishment of God, as is just for their years of worshiping idols and opposing God. And now Isaiah says to the beasts of the field and the forest, "Come and get it. Come on in. It's chow time. It's a grisly thing. He's saying there'll be lots of corpses around. It's lunchtime, and he calls the animals in to devour what's left of the destruction. And why? We say, why would God let that happen to his people? Why did God allow his people to be invaded by and destroyed by, torn to pieces by the Babylonians and the wild animals after them? And the answer is because they were wicked. Verse 10 shows us that the wicked are ignorant. His watchmen are blind. All of them know nothing, he says. The watchmen is a reference to the religious leaders who are supposed to be standing guard. They were supposed to be watching over the souls of the people, like we are to be watching over one another's well-being, and especially leaders are. But these leaders are wicked people. They are ignorant. They're blind, and they know nothing. Verse 11 says they are shepherds who have no understanding. Verse 12 says, tomorrow will be like today, only more so. This with judgment hanging over them, impending doom before them. And they're saying in their ignorance, tomorrow will be like today, but more so. Totally wrong. And verse 1 of chapter 57 says intriguingly that people just don't take to heart or understand what's going on when, for example, God causes a righteous man to perish. These people were living on the brink of judgment, and Isaiah was saying that in some cases God's mercy is extended to some righteous people by letting them die, and they die so as to escape the terrible tribulation that's about to break out upon them. It's the mercy of God by which they die. It's the mercy of God by which they escape judgment through death and being ushered into the presence of the Lord. But no one takes it to heart. No one understands. They don't get it. They look at a righteous man being mercifully taken away to heaven and they say, oh, he must have done something wrong. He's being punished. And no, they're misunderstanding. The wicked are ignorant. Back in verse 10 of chapter 56, we see too that the wicked are lazy. All of them are dumb dogs, unable to bark. They're like watchmen. These religious leaders are like watch dogs, but they're dumb dogs. They're unable to bark. Why are they unable to bark? Because they lack the energy. They're dreamers lying down who love to slumber. They're ignorant and they're lazy. And verse 11 says that they are greedy. The dogs are greedy. They're not satisfied. Each one turns to his unjust gain, to the last one. They're gripped with these elements of which wickedness is comprised. And as a result, look at verse 12. They're big into drinking. They like to get drunk. Let's get wine and let's drink heavily of strong drink. I'll leave you to sort out whether the love of drunkenness is a matter of ignorance or laziness or greed or some combination of those. But just drunkenness is a result of these other character faults. And then verse 4 shows us that they're flippant. Against whom do you jest, they're asked. Against whom do you open your mouth and stick out your tongue? Your children of rebellion, your offspring of deceit. Their flippancy, their refusal to take serious things seriously comes from their wickedness. And their wickedness gets to full form when in verse 5 and on you see them giving themselves over to the worship of idols. You inflame yourselves among the oaks. That's a reference to the groves of trees where idols were worshipped. Under every luxuriant tree, you slaughter the children in the ravines, under the clefts of the crags. Here are people in their wickedness crazed to the point of worshiping idols, to the point of throwing their babies into furnaces and burning them alive as a sacrifice to the god Molech. That's what was going on in the days of Isaiah. It was unspeakable. It was unimaginable what these people were doing. And they were doing it because they were wicked. And what kind of life does this sort of wicked behavior result in? Are these people at peace? No, quite the opposite. Look at chapter 57, verse 11. It says, you were worried and fearful. God asks, of whom were you worried and fearful when you lied and didn't remember me? They are worried and fearful. But verse 11 goes on to say, you don't fear me. They are worried and fearful, but they do not fear God. And this is a page out of last week's book as we looked on Mother's Day, not at Isaiah, but at a subject related to parenting. It's a message we've seen before. If you will fear God, if you will properly revere God, then you do not need to fear anything else. You can be fearless. The righteous are as bold as a lion, but the wicked flee when no one is pursuing. If you will fear God, you don't have to fear anyone. But these people don't fear God. So they have many things to fear. They're full of worries. They're full of fear. Think about them. They live for one drinking party after another, and they're worshiping idols to the point of insanity, actually killing their babies to please a statue. These people are practically out of their minds. And are they at peace? No, they're totally a mess. They're worried and they're fearful, and they don't fear God. Now think about this with me for a minute. When we look to the subject of peace, what was the connection between relationship to God and everything else? The relationship was this, that in terms of peace, your relationship to God is foundational to all other aspects of peace, right? You can't be at peace with your circumstances. You can't be at peace with people until you're at peace with God. So in terms of peace, the subject of peace, relationship to God is absolutely fundamental. Now, on the subject of wickedness, what's the connection between relationship to God and every other thing? I hope you can see it's the very same thing. We ask ourselves the question, why do these people not fear God? Why don't they have a proper respect for God? Is it because they're so wicked? Well, that would make some sense. They're doing things that burn their conscience. They're doing things that fill them with an agony of guilt. So of course they don't respect God. Of course they don't care about God. They've got to lock God away. They've got to ignore him because the guilt would kill them if they faced up to the fact that there is a God. So yeah, you would say their wickedness causes them to not fear God. But that's down the path of decline. That's a product of the digression that's being explained in the scriptures. Romans chapter 1, the chapter upon which the whole gospel explanation is grounded in Paul's writing to the Romans, explains that it's actually in the first place the other way around. It's not that they don't fear God because they're so wicked. It's that they are so wicked because they don't fear God. The first instance of wickedness, the foundational wickedness, is a refusal to acknowledge God. And because they won't get right with God, because they won't properly fear God, all the other wickedness results. That's what Romans 1 says. All the other wickedness results from God letting them go loose and turning them over to a depraved mind and taking off the leash so that they can run wild. They run off in all these directions of moral insanity because in the first place they have refused to acknowledge God. They won't worship the Creator, so they turn to the creature. And that's what Romans 1 says really plainly. So as to the relationship in regard to the aspect of peace, the relationship to God is foundational. And in regard to the wickedness of the world, again, relationship to God is foundational. If you are right with God, God will lead you away from wickedness. But if you are refuse to get right with God, you will plunge into wickedness. So there's no peace without peace with God. And there's great wickedness when there's no peace with God. And all of this put together can lead us to what is, I think, one of the punchlines this morning. And I say to my chagrin that there's no place to write this punchline. So you'll have to scrawl it in somewhere. But don't scrawl it in so sloppily that it won't be legible. Besides, the person who is sort of against you because you're such a slob will say, see, you can't even write neatly. Here's the punchline, okay? There's no peace. There's no real peace. And I mean this on all levels, with circumstances, with people, with God himself. There's no real peace while you are at war with God. As long as you continue to war with God, you will not have any peace on any level. You may have the illusion of peace for a while. The scriptures say, why do the wicked prosper? They seem to be at peace, but it's just an illusion. It's a short-term thing. There's no real peace until you are at war with God. While you are at war with God. There's no peace until you cease to be at war with God. See, I wrote it kind of sloppy and I couldn't see what it was. Now look, when you are at war, there's only three ways to get out of it. If you are at war, there's only three ways to get out of it. You can stop fighting about the thing you're fighting about. You know, there was World War II. Britain declared war on Germany, right? You know that? Hitler didn't want to go to war. He just wanted to gobble up Europe. So when he got into Poland, Britain declared war on him, right? And if he'd given back Poland, the war would be over. If he'd just back off. That's one way to get out of war. You stop fighting over the thing you're fighting over. That's one way to get out of war. Another way to get out of war is to defeat your enemy. Clobber him good, and then the war is over. He sues for peace. The third way to get out of war is to be defeated, to admit defeat. So you can stop fighting over the issue over which the war is being fought, or you can conquer your enemy, you can defeat him, or thirdly, you can admit defeat. And that's what's true when you are in a war, except when you are at war with God. And if you are at war with God, option one and option two get taken off the books. Because there will never be an end to the conflict over which the war is being fought. Because the war is being fought over the rights to your life. And your war with God is sparked by the fact that you act as if you own your life. And God acts as if he owns your life. That's what the war has been fought over. And you say, it's mine. And God says, no, it's not. It is mine. I'm your creator. I've made you. And God will never stop fighting you over that issue. He'll never say, okay, it's, you're right. You're the center of the universe. I see it now. God will never say that. So you'll never get out of war on grounds one. Neither will you ever get out of war with God on grounds two. You will never defeat God. You will never hear God say, I give up. God will never wave a white flag and say, ooh, didn't think you'd be so tough to fight. That's not going to happen either. So now we're down to one and only one way to get out of war with God, and that is for you to admit defeat, for you to wave the white flag, for you to surrender. And good things begin to happen when we stop warring with God. And the only way to stop warring with God is agree that he is the center of the universe, that your life belongs to him, that your nerve endings and your brain and your plans all are his property to do with what he will, because he owns you, because he created you. And you wave the white flag and you surrender to God. There's no real peace while you are at war with God. And this is what we see in chapter 57, verse 15. And although it's a good thing to bring your Bible, and you might be able to turn your Bible to it, if you didn't, good news, it's printed here on your sermon outline. Verse 15 is printed. And here's what God says to those he's at war with. For thus says the high and exalted one who lives forever, whose name is holy. That's God, who's high and lifted up. His ways are above our ways. His thoughts are above our thoughts. Isaiah's taught us that already. He's holy. God showed Isaiah that when he appeared to Isaiah, and the angel said, holy, holy, holy. This is God. And he says, I dwell on a high and holy place. And we've known that about God already. He's high and exalted, and he dwells on a high and holy place. But look what else he says. He says, and also, that is, I also dwell with the contrite and the lowly of spirit. I also dwell with the contrite and the lowly of spirit. So this is our punchline. There's no real peace while you're at war with God, and the only way to get out of war is to admit defeat, to be contrite, to be lowly, to surrender, to wave the white flag and say, well, there's no future in fighting God over the property rights to me. So I admit defeat, I will agree that God is God, and I will change sides. I will start fighting on the side that says my life belongs to God and must be lived entirely for him. That's called being contrite or broken or surrendered. That's called being lowly of spirit. And God promises to dwell with those people. He who's high and holy promises to come down and live with those people, to be right with you. We sang about that. In your heart of hearts I will dwell, we sing as we get this right. And God comes and dwells with us. And what would that be like? He was our enemy. We were fighting him. We were opposed to him because he wanted to take over our lives and we wanted to live our lives for ourselves. But we give up the battle. We surrender to him, and he comes and lives with us. And what does that look like? Well, here's what he has to say about that in this 15th verse. I dwell on a high and holy place, and also with the contrite and lowly of spirit, in order to revive the spirit of the lowly and to revive the heart of the contrite. That's what happens when God comes to dwell with you. He revives you. You know what revive means? It means bring back to life. Vive, viva, vitality, that's life. Revive, to bring back to life. God does not mean to get you into a state of defeat so that you can live in a state of defeat and making known the greatness of God by how defeated we seem. No, God means to move us to a level of life far surpassing our own capabilities. Jesus said, I've come that you might have life and that you might have it abundantly. But the question is, how is he going to get you to that state of eternal, of abundant life? Oh, he's going to get you there by getting you to stop living the sort of life you're capable of living. So you admit that you can't go on. You give up living for yourself. You give yourself to him contritely and lowly. You admit defeat. You wave the white flag and you come out with your hands up. And he revives you. He comes and lives with you and he revives you. He gives you life. He brings you to life. Now you'll have a whole new dimension of living. A dimension which includes peace in regard to all your circumstances. And in regard to the fact that many of us have waged this war for a long time before we finally get it right, God addresses all of the wounds that we've taken, all of the hurt we've done to ourselves, all the ways in which people have hurt us because we've not been at peace with God and with our circumstances. And that's what verses 18 and 19 says as well. I have seen his ways, God says. And he's not talking about his righteous prophet here. It's not I've seen his favorable, his godly, his holy ways. He's talking about the wicked here. I've seen his wicked ways. I've seen how morally rebellious he has been. But I will heal him. I will heal him. He sees what damage you've done to yourself by waging war with God. He sees how you have deprived yourself of the joy that only comes from being fully surrendered to God, and he offers to heal you of that. He says, I will lead him and restore comfort to him. I will lead him and restore comfort to him and to his mourners. Who are the mourners? Those are the people who are down in the mouth. Those are the people who are miserable because you're miserable. Those are the people who regret to see a life wasted. But God restores comfort to those who admit defeat. God restores comfort to those who stop warring with him, and comfort to the mourners, those who have been grieved with what a state you've fallen into. And that's peace. That's peace with circumstances. That's peace with each other. It's rests upon peace with God. And the result is the praise of lips. It's God's intention to be gloriously praised. It's his intention to be glorified by people who get this sorted out. So God takes us to a place where we are contrite. He takes us to a place where we are lowly in spirit so that we can get to a place we would never get to on our own, no matter how much we care about the quality of our life. He gets us to a state of quality that's totally out of reach. And there we will be restored. There our comfort will be restored. There he will lead us and heal us and revive us. And so with all of this prospect before us, he says, this is verse 19, peace. Peace to him who is far, and to him who is near, says the Lord, and I will heal him. Peace to him who is far, peace to him who is near. Now, the one who is far is easy to figure out. That's the guy who's living to get drunk, who's worshiping idols, whether it's little statues that he's burning babies to, or whether it's the more sophisticated idols of our society, the idols of prosperity and financial success and physical fitness and all the idols that we worship. Those are the people he's addressing when he says, peace to him who is far. You can be done with all of that. You can get into a state of peace if you will give up living for those things and live for God instead. But what about peace to him who is near? Who's that that God is offering peace to? I would say it has to be the people who have already, at least in theory, acknowledged defeat. Those who perhaps in principle have already said, yes, there's no point in fighting City Hall, and God is God, and I'll live for him. People with a testimony, people who are Christians. Why do they need peace? Because perhaps in some back corner of your life, down in some dark recess of your soul, there's still a little ground that you're holding on to, a little corner of the kingdom that you refuse to give up. You know, I've heard, it might be urban legend, but I've heard that years after World War II was over, they found in some South Sea islands little battalions of Japanese soldiers who were still holding out, still fighting the American imperialists. And the war was long over, but they refused to give up their little turf. I don't know if that's true or not, but it'd be a great illustration if it was, wouldn't it? That's what we do. Perhaps we admit defeat big scale and we give up the big issues of our life, but deep down in the recesses of our lives, there's little tiny corners that we hold on to, and we don't mean to give that away. And God says to those of us who are near to him through our general surrender to him, I offer you peace as well. You can be revived. You can have life in the dark places of your life. We can shine light into there and give you abundant life if you will go through the same process and surrender that little piece of turf to me. Acknowledge my ownership of that particular part of your life as well. So the punchlines are, no real peace while you're at war with God. The only way to be at peace is to surrender. And God doesn't mean to keep you defeated. He means to give you real life. Those are the conclusions. And they bring us to the question about surrender, the question about your own particular relationship to God. The very basis upon which you have any hope of being at peace with your circumstances, the very basis upon which you will live a life of wickedness or be cured of your wickedness. It's just this, your relationship to God. And the question is, have you surrendered? Ever had a white flag waving from a pole in your hand? Have you ever come out with your hands up? Have you ever given the turf back to God? Have you ever realized it's absolutely crazy? It's worse than crazy. It's spiritual, everlasting suicide to wage war with the God who holds you together. Here you are saying, I want my life. And you use the voice box he gave you to say it. And you stand there while the heart that he built for you pumps with the energy that he uses to pump your blood. And your lungs continue to respirate because he's decided they will continue to respirate. And you're alive because God holds you together. All the atoms of your body hold together just by an act of God's will. And you take what he's given you and say, I don't think I need you. It's nonsense. It's spiritually suicide, and it's nonsense. And why would you keep that up? Why would you keep that up? So what would you say to the soldiers who, 20 years after World War II was over, were still fighting World War II? You say, come to your senses. Come on. Don't be stupid. You got life. You could live in peace. Wouldn't you say that? So what do you say when you look in the mirror and you see a man or a woman who's still fighting God? Tell yourself what no one else will say to you. Say, why be stupid? And instead, turn to God. Surrender. Wave the white flag. Be contrite. Be lowly. Give yourself entirely to God. And in view of the goodness of God, go ahead and be a good loser. Go ahead and be a happy loser. Come out with your hands up and say, I surrender. I'm ready for life now. I'm ready for peace. You can become that stunning exhibit of the greatness of God, who is at peace in all your circumstances, at peace with people as far as it depends upon you, because at peace with God. All you need to do is surrender. The question is, have you surrendered? If you've surrendered in general, have you surrendered in specifics? Is there some little aspect of your life, your internet life, your television life, your relationship life that you haven't surrendered? Well, don't be stupid. Don't be a little ongoing battle guy about that. But give yourself up to God entirely and experience his reviving power in that dimension of your life as well. And we will be the people at peace. The people whose lives declare that God is a great, great.